Welcome to the Bulgarian History Podcast, episode 206, A Dream Realized? Now, first, I want to thank our latest patron, Gabriela Petrova. Big thanks to you, Gabriela. And with that said, let's get into it. Last time, we covered the period between Bulgaria's decision to join the Central Powers and the actual beginning of the war for Bulgaria. In that time, Tsar Ferdinand had a raucous meeting with the political groups in opposition, with the agrarian leader Stambolijski ultimately ending up imprisoned for life on treason charges after publishing anti-war literature. Otherwise, there were some brief border skirmishes with the Serbs before officially joining the war on the 1st of October. When the news broke, it landed like a bombshell in Paris and London in particular, leading to harsh criticism of the diplomatic failure and even the resignation of the French Prime Minister. Now, Bulgaria seems poised to quickly conquer Macedonia, though French and British forces have already landed at Thessaloniki with the aim of stopping them. To be certain, the Bulgarian army is in a difficult state after so much fighting in recent years, but the Serbs are barely holding it together, and have just lost Belgrade for the second time. As the fighting begins for Bulgaria, it remains to be seen just how easy this war will actually be. So, what happened when the fighting began? Now, it should come as no shock that the Bulgarians were able to quickly push the Serbs back. Considering how well Bulgaria had performed when facing the Serbs alone, facing a Serbian army helplessly overstretched as it was pretty unlikely to pose a big challenge to the Bulgarian side. In fact, on the day the Bulgarian army began its attacks, the head of the Serbian army telegraphed the French general in charge of their forces, asking that French troops advance north to meet the Serbs as quickly as possible. Now, as always, when I'm covering a war like this, I highly recommend going to the blog post linked to this episode description to look at the map I provided there, because the map makes everything easier to kind of picture what exactly is happening, but I'll try my best to make it pretty clear. Because yeah, ultimately, even I struggle a bit to keep all the locations in my head, and I've, lived in this region and covered it for more than a decade. But with all that said, we're going to start covering the north. Remember that by the time Bulgaria entered the war, the Serbian kind of lines to the north had effectively been broken on a fairly wide front. Belgrade, as I mentioned, had recently fallen to a joint Austro-German force, and the Central Powers, the Austro-Germans, were kind of steadily advancing towards the south. As a result, the Germans ordered the Bulgarian First Army in the north to advance to Niš, and then north along the Morava River to link up with them. For the Bulgarian First Army, tasked with advancing into quote-unquote Old Serbia, the advance was initially easy, but they soon found themselves slowed down by really bad weather, which turned the dirt roads to mud, and the addition of fog and reduced visibility made things just very difficult, despite not meeting a whole lot of resistance. This, combined with tough terrain, did allow the Serbs to halt the Bulgarian advance about 15 kilometers into Serbian territory at the fortresses of Pirot and Zaječar. This army will spend the first 11 days of the war overcoming these barriers before finally taking the fortresses and resuming their advance. So, what was happening in the south during this first stage of the war? Let's start with what was happening with the French and British. Now, their aim was, as we know, to move north to Skopje to protect Macedonia and, crucially, to protect the rail line linking Thessaloniki with the Serbs because, well, that was how any reinforcement supplies, anything, could reach the Serbs. And by the time the war began, the Franco-British force was just reaching the Greco-Serbian border. So they were just entering, the Serbian-controlled portion of Vardar Macedonia, essentially. But despite the Serbian pleas to advance as quickly as possible, that is not what was happening. Sure, the French had moved into Serbia, but it took an additional 8 days for the British troops to receive permission to follow them. But these forces also faced a difficult dilemma. If they rushed north as quickly as possible, then they're more vulnerable to flanking attacks by advancing Bulgarian forces. On the other hand, if they advance more cautiously, they might fail to reach the Serbs in time and provide desperately needed help. So, as the Bulgarians were beginning their advance, the French forces were just moving into Macedonia and setting up defensive positions along the Vardar River, about one-third of the way from the Bulgarian border to the Albanian one. So if you think of, you know, the contemporary country of North Macedonia, from right to left, they're setting up about one-third of the way to the left from the Bulgarian border. So that first third of Vardar Macedonia is not really being contested. Now, once the British began advancing, they moved to the town of Dorian on the Vardar River as well, just over the border. Now, frankly, the Franco-British force understood that with their 13,000 men, they weren't realistically going to hold back 300,000 Bulgarians. So their primary aim was just to delay the Bulgarian advance to give the Serbs time to retreat towards Albania, towards the sea, and towards safety. As a result of the decision not to focus on defending that first third or so of Vardar Macedonia, the Bulgarian Second Army advanced far more rapidly into Macedonia, despite being much smaller than that First Army to the north. Just 2 days after the war began, they did manage to cut that vital rail link between Serbia and Greece by taking the town of Vranje. Now, the Serbs still had a route to escape, but that route now passed through treacherous terrain, mostly mountains. The only rail line connecting them to the outside world was now cut, and there was no realistic way for Serbia's allies to get any substantial supplies to them. Now, by October the 7th, this southern force took the Macedonian town of Kumanovo, the site of one of Serbia's main battles in the First Balkan War, almost exactly 3 years earlier. Just a few days later, Bulgarian forces reached and quickly took Skopje and Veles. This meant that the Bulgarian Second Army had already completed several major objectives, blocking any Serbian retreat south along the Vardar Valley towards Greece and the Anglo-French forces, and preventing that allied force from helping the Serbs directly. Hall writes how, quote, "The French initially regarded their Bulgarian foes with some condescension. They reckoned that the spirit of the army was poor because of the inherent Bulgarian Russophilia," end quote. Now, frankly, I found the fact that even the French army still held on to the belief that the Bulgarians were so inherently Russophilic that this would prevent their army from operating effectively against a Russian ally in order to obtain Macedonia of all places, to be kind of fascinating, bizarre, naive, a lot of things. But as we're seeing here, that was a belief very much mistaken. Now, yeah, again, it's funny. As if fighting against the French to take Macedonia, the territory that has been a kind of singular obsession for the Bulgarian people for decades, was going to be hampered by the fact that France was allied with Russia, it's a silly notion. But it goes to show that many leaders within the European great powers still don't really understand Bulgaria or its people, despite, you know, Bulgaria now being an independent state for decades. Well, fully independent for just over a decade, somewhat independent for a couple decades, you know what I mean. In fact, less than 3 weeks after the war began, the main church of Bulgarian Orthodoxy, Alexander Nevsky, was renamed to Saints Equal to the Apostles, Cyril and Methodius. Doesn't really roll off the tongue, but still, it's still kind of weird and absurd that even today that the main Bulgarian Orthodox Church is named after Alexander Nevsky, who you'll recall was the patron saint of Tsar Alexander II of Russia, the Tsar at the time of the liberation in 1878-1879. But Alexander Nevsky as a person had no connection with Bulgaria whatsoever, just happened to be the patron saint of that particular Russian Tsar. So now, for the first time, Bulgaria's grandest and most beautiful church no longer bore the name of a Russian saint with no connection to the country. But although the Anglo-French force, as I said, wasn't having much success holding back the Bulgarian advance, they were taking advantage of the fact that Bulgaria did not possess an Aegean navy to freely bombard Bulgaria's brand new ports on that sea. And, well, there was very little the Bulgarians could do in response, and there was real fear that the Entente might attempt a landing there. But for now, the focus remained on the Western Front with Serbia. Now, about 10 days into the war, the Northern Force finally began advancing again, taking Negotin, Brza Palanka, and Prahovo along the Danube, as well as Knyazhevets and the fortress of Pirot and Zayachar. In essence, this meant that the first series of major defensive fortresses and settlements had all been overcome. And this meant that contact was finally established with the Germans. And the First Army in the north could then begin to pivot to the southwest to chase the retreating Serbs towards Kosovo. Meanwhile, to the south, Bulgarian forces finally encountered the French and were prevented from taking a key railway bridge in Rabrovo. The French force was holding on to a bridgehead on the eastern bank of the Vardar River and soon threw up two bridges to keep it supplied. A Bulgarian attempt to take these bridges failed, resulting in 3,000 casualties, as the advancing units lacked any cover from murderous French fire. The Bulgarian Second Army in the south was by now divided into two forces, one facing north to push the Serbs, and another facing south to face the Anglo-French. It was decided that this army could now shift its focus to cutting off a Serbian retreat through Kosovo towards Albania, while largely remaining on the defensive against the Anglo-French forces to the south. But they still did make some key advances, taking the city of Veles on the Vardar River. Now, realizing the danger they were in at this stage, the Serbian army began a full-scale retreat in the direction of Kosovo with the aim of making a stand at Pristina. Field Marshal von Mackensen intended to encircle the Serbs there and inflict a decisive defeat. So, the Bulgarian First Army in the north was now pushing towards Kosovo, capturing the temporary Serbian capital of Niš, taking thousands of prisoners in the process. The next day, on the 24th of October, they captured Leskovac and progressed southwest. But the two branches of the Morava River were posing problems and delaying the Bulgarian drive. The Serbs managed some small successful counterattacks, but all these delays were just that, delays. Now by this point, bad weather that had plagued the Central Powers for the first 3 weeks of the campaign finally gave way to improved conditions. This allowed for reconnaissance flights that kept von Mackensen abreast of where Serbian forces were as they retreated. The situation for the Serbs, meanwhile, was quickly deteriorating. They had been forced to abandon vast quantities of equipment in their retreat and had to travel alongside masses of civilian refugees and even Austro-Hungarian prisoners of war. This was the state of their army as they finally reached the Kosovo plain, the location of their great defeat against the Ottomans that had sealed the fate of the medieval Serbian kingdom 467 years prior. The symbolism of this location was really not lost on anyone on either side. Here, the Serbs faced a daunting decision. Should they stand and fight, or should they retreat across the treacherous Montenegrin and Albanian mountains, which lay at their backs? Ultimately, the decision was made to retreat. There was little prospect of holding off the massive combined German, Bulgarian, Austro-Hungarian force which lay before them, and getting supplies through those mountains was going to be nearly impossible. Again, if you've been to those mountains, you know they are, even today with much better infrastructure and things, they are treacherous. Thus, the Serbian army, with civilians and prisoners in tow, divided itself into three columns, with one retreating through southern Montenegro, another through central Kosovo and northern Albania, and a third south towards Prizren and towards the Adriatic port of Durres. The plan was for all three to converge at Lake Skutari before being evacuated through Adriatic ports. Some Austrian and German troops did pursue them, but the elements and Albanian locals did most of the work of whittling away at the army, civilians, and the prisoners of war. Now, interestingly, when the Austro-Hungarians entered the region that used to be the Ottoman Sanjak of Novi Pazar, a territory the Austro-Hungarians had actually governed for a while, they were greeted as liberators by local Muslims who remembered their rule fondly after enduring Serbian and Montenegrin rule for the past 2 years. Now, most of Kosovo was taken in the first week and a half of November, including a lot of equipment, but this majority of the Serbian army did slip away. The Austro-Hungarians occupied the northern part of the region, while the Bulgarians took the south. In particular, the Austro-Hungarians were here greeted as liberators as well, as by this time local Albanians saw them as an ally, owing in part to the support of an independent Albanian state by the Austro-Hungarians during the Balkan Wars, which you might remember. Even before the conquest of Kosovo was complete, Bulgarian and German general staffs decided to meet and discuss the next steps, particularly regarding how to deal with Entente forces that were currently arriving in Greece. So again, just to give you an idea here, right, the Serbs have been decisively defeated. You know, their retreat, in full-scale retreat over the mountains, they're gone. What used to be, you know, Serbia and parts of Montenegro are all being occupied. But even though there's kind of a stalemate to the south in the southern part of Macedonia, still the Entente forces are funneling more and more troops into Thessaloniki, and so that front is gradually becoming more dangerous. Now, the Germans ultimately assigned 4 divisions and additional artillery to help the Bulgarian drive south to the Greek border. However, as Hall notes, there was a bit of a misunderstanding here, with the Bulgarians interpreting the support as a signal of German support for their attack to the south, while the Germans just felt they were providing some reinforcements. So this is going to become a bigger kind of disagreement of what to do here, because remember, Greece is still not technically in the war, and any crossing of the Greek border could bring them into the war on the side of the Entente, which would not be great for the Central Powers. So I'll talk about it more, but it's a weird situation. So while Entente forces on that Macedonian front are still fairly weak, that wasn't guaranteed to remain the case, because again, troops are being funneled in. The chief of staff, German chief of staff, Erich von Falkenhayn, noted that, quote, "The Entente could send a division to Macedonia more easily than the Germans could a battalion." Now, for reference, a division generally has somewhere between 10 to 18 times as many men as a battalion. Just kind of reinforcing the fact that getting troops to this place through the very large and very modern port of Thessaloniki was much easier than transporting them overland all the way across Austria-Hungary through Serbia's devastated logistical network. Now, aside from all these challenges, Germany also worried that advancing too far south again would bring Greece into the war on the Entente side. But on the other hand, if the war in the Balkans could be concluded entirely, Bulgaria might just leave the Central Powers entirely because, well, there was no war near Bulgaria. Bulgaria didn't really want to send its soldiers, I don't know, to the Western Front or to go fight Russia, certainly. So, you know, even concluding the war here posed significant dangers. So, for now, the aim was still to push the Entente forces to the Greek border. Both Bulgaria and Austria-Hungary felt that it was necessary to then push into Greece and drive the Entente out of the Balkans completely. But doing so was really outside of Bulgaria's capabilities, and the Germans did not want to allow this to happen. So for now, the goal is to push the the Anglo-French force to the Greek border. Now, in the meantime, the Bulgarian Second Army is still making good progress, taking Prilep on November the 1st and then Tetovo on the 3rd. But there was still brutal fighting with the French around Krivolak, and ultimately this resulted in the French government ordering a retreat south to Bitola. And by this point, the Entente had transported around 160,000 soldiers to Thessaloniki, meaning that for every soldier the Bulgarians were currently facing, there were 2 more that had arrived in Greece but not yet made it to the front. By now, the Bulgarian military and political leaders were becoming more and more concerned about this situation, understandably so. They had anticipated an easy victory against Serbia, and well, they had gotten that. But what they had not anticipated was facing this huge Anglo-French force in Macedonia, with Tsar Ferdinand himself writing, quote, "I understood much too late the terrible danger that threatens our army from the French and British," end quote. Yet, despite these growing concerns, Bulgarian advances in Macedonia continued through November, taking Krushevo, Rezin, and ultimately Bitola itself. Soon, the Second Army reached Ohrid, Struga, and other points on the Albanian border. And so, by the end of November, nearly all of Vardar Macedonia was in Bulgarian hands. The one major holdout was a defensive position on the Kosturino Ridge south of Strumica. Here, the Bulgarians and British engaged in brutal fighting, including bayonet charges across rocky terrain. Ultimately, the Anglo-French force was pushed back to the Greek border here as well. So, as November turned to December, Bulgaria had seemingly achieved its great national ambition of taking Macedonia, of course, minus the Greek portion of Macedonia. The Bulgarians were already forming new territorial districts around Vardar Macedonia and the Morava region of Serbia in anticipation of ultimately annexing these lands formally. So, did all this mean that Bulgaria's dream, its great national ambition, was finally realized? Or was it just that? A dream that feels so real until you're rudely awakened by the world's brutal realities. Because the inability to pursue the Entente forces into Greece meant that the war in the Balkans was getting ready to transform into a stalemate. And not even a typical stalemate, you know, where just neither side can really push each other, but a kind of weird legal stalemate where one side can't push the other and the opposing side can't push because they don't want to enter that territory. It's again, a weird situation. But this is also crucially a stalemate in which the Entente can freely build up its forces in northern Greece to prepare for future attacks at will, with no one really able to stop them. So that was a military situation by December. Back on the political front in Bulgaria, this same period saw a committee of the National Assembly conclude an investigation into the conduct of Geshov and Danov, their governments, during the Balkan Wars. And I'll quote Stateleva on the result of that committee. Quote, "The committee's work concluded with a report stating that the Balkan War had begun in spite of the advice of Russia and the powers of the Entente, that the government had known of the Serbs' intention to not respect the Allied agreement, that Sofia had counted on the support of Russian public opinion, and so on." End quote. So, yeah, it concluded that the governments of Geshov and Danov should have known better than sort of getting into the war, but the committee did ultimately decide not to prosecute the government officials involved. So emotions are running high over the question of who was to blame for these disasters, but ultimately a trial was not the right way to move forward. Now, I want to finish this episode by covering the fate of the Serbian army as they retreated to the Adriatic for evacuation. And I want to quote the diary of a Slovene volunteer who was traveling with the Serbian army to give you some idea of the conditions they were facing. Quote, "We slowly creep towards the sheer cliffs of Mount Chakor, step by step on the compacted snow. This is the mountain of death. Yesterday, we saw the dead, frozen, and sticking out of the snow. Here, on the edge of the mountain of death, the sights are still worse. On either side of the ice road, refugees are resting. Immobilized by the snow, their heads are glued to their breasts. The white snowflakes dance around them while the alpine winds whistle their songs of death. The heads of horses and oxen that have fallen off the path protrude from the snow. Somehow, we make it over Chakor, although we are still in the empire of mountains. On a plateau below Chakor's peak, we see a mound of human bodies. Barefoot, without coats, uniforms in shreds. Nothing covers their heads. These are the remains of the Austrian POWs who have been left here in their thousands. Their bodies are just skeletons, their faces despair. Those still living sway about aimlessly in the deep snow, a vain attempt at saving themselves. A bunch of these miserable creatures come across a frozen horse in the snow. They throw themselves at it like hungry wolves, stripping away its body piece by piece. Oh, poor wretches. Brother Czechs and other Slavs who never wanted to be dragooned into another Austrian fight. Now, you too must carry the cross of Golgotha together with the Serbian people." End quote. All along this path, the Serbian soldiers were harassed by Albanian irregulars eager for revenge on the army that had committed such horrors on Albanians just years earlier. The British anthropologist Edith Durham later commented, quote, "That they suffered great hardships on the way is because they fled through districts that they had completely pillaged and devastated barely 2 years before. That the Albanians spared the lives of the retreating Serbs who had previously shown them no mercy is to their horror." End quote. Ultimately, the number of dead and missing are staggering. Around 150,000 Serbian soldiers were either dead or missing by this point, plus another 47,000 POWs and some 160,000 civilians. Now, to give you an idea, that's the equivalent of nearly the entire population of Montenegro at this time, dead within a few weeks. As the Serbs departed, the Austro-Hungarians took control of Montenegro for themselves. The Serbs had requested food be sent ahead to greet them in Albania, but the presence of the Austro-Hungarian Navy in the Adriatic prevented this. It was ultimately decided that the Serbs would be taken to the French-occupied island of Corfu, and from there to Tunisia. And that's where I'll finish things off today. So, we've reached December of 1915, and at face value, all Bulgaria's dreams have been realized. Serbia has been defeated, most of the territory Bulgaria wants has been obtained, and the war is barely 2 months old. Yet, the Entente forces in Greece remain a grave threat, despite all these brutal losses. Tens of thousands of Serbian soldiers have lived to fight another day, and the question is whether or not that day might come. So next time, we'll cover the aftermath of these victories as Bulgaria faces the question of what to do now. This episode was written and produced by me, Eric Halsey. The theme music was written and performed by Teddy Raven. As always, you can check out more information at bghistorypodcast.com. And with that, uspech, or good luck.